Is the market in rotation? What is Jerry's outlook for gold?
This is Jerry Toome with Smart Money, a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services with Cornerstone President and Founder, Jerry Toome. Jerry Toome is a certified financial planner. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member, FINRA, and SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Toome Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station, or its management, or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. We are here to talk about your finances, investments, and the economy, and we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.
Welcome to Smart Money with Jerry Toome. This is Michael Williams. Well, Jerry, the market's been acting up for the past week or so. People aren't sure what quite to make of it. I had a, while we were at the NRB this week, I had a day trader corner me for about 30 minutes wanting to know our views on the market. And but his take is so different because his view is so minuscule. And he's not dealing with retirement money. He's dealing with fund money. So I told him I don't think our views apply to him at all.
No, not really, for sure.
But he is aware of the change that's going on in the market, so it'd be interesting to get your take on that.
Yeah, it would be. Nashville Religious Broadcasters was the convention we were at, and I hadn't been there in years. I think I stopped going after Mona, my wife's first cancer battle, but felt good to get reacquainted and meet a lot of people I've known for years. The market, to me, right now, best we can tell, is just in a garden variety correction. Now, the one thing that's probably not garden variety is there is a rotation going on. So the winners of last year, which was, I mean, the last I read, I think it was Ned Davis, it might have been Strategus, said that about 50% of the return for the S&P 500 last year was the top seven stocks, the Mag 7. You know, and probably most of you know, that's Meta, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Google kind of thing. And so the issue is that they produced about half the stock market's return last year, but those things don't carry forever. So the question is, was that the end of a sort of a little mini mania for those stocks, and they go back to the rest of the herd, and the herd catches up and passes them? That's sort of what's been happening this year. So you had people that, essentially, we know how this works. At the end of the quarter, at the end of the year, it's a race to the finish line. So everybody's sprinting to get to the finish line and get the highest production they can in December. And that typically means whoever the winners are for that year, you jump, lock, stock, and barrel, full feet, 4 feet. You don't have 4 feet, 2 feet. Anyway, you jump into the winners of the last of this whole year, and then you just try to ride that all the way to the finish line. Then you have a reassessment phase, and this happens almost every year. You have a reassessment phase. Sometimes it starts in January. Late January is pretty common, sometimes February, and I think we're still sort of in that reassessment phase. And so what we've seen so far, we saw more defensive type stocks have been leading this year. Utilities, consumer staples, things like that are more conservative, they're typically not high growth stocks. Those have been leading. The growth stocks, winners from last year, there's been a rotation out of them, out of favor. The question is really, have they hit the peak? We call it the terminal peak, meaning the last peak of their major run or not. And the jury's out on that. You can't tell yet. Part of me says maybe so. There, if you look at the comparison of the Nifty 50, the Magnificent 7 to other manias like the dot-coms or the Nifty 50 in the 1972 time frame, they haven't hit as extreme on valuations as those kind of markets did. So hypothetically, you could see another run of them starting later this year or whenever. It can't pause very long or it will, that negates everything. So in other words, if you have a run up, you've had a run up, and I don't have the stocks in front of me, but most of them had run ups and now have peaked and are coming back down. There are a couple of exceptions, but the bottom line is you're not going to have a run up like that, put this dunce cap looking peak on it, and then have it continue if you have a very long pause. So in other words, if you have a pause that lasts a few weeks, maybe a couple, 3 months, that's okay. But you're not going to go back into those more speculative, and I don't, when I say speculative, I don't mean the stocks themselves are speculative. They have solid earnings, they have solid outlooks. The issue is if they've become overbought and too leveraged and too many people chasing the same stocks,
their valuations out of whack.
Valuations get too expensive, and they're not outrageously expensive like two of the other menus we've had, but they're still very expensive compared to the rest of the market. So the question is this a rotation out of those and into other things, or is that just temporary? And that's, jury is out on that. We don't know. I think we'll know within a month or two. So we'll find out either one. Last summer we had a similar thing. Last summer in July when the Japanese carry trade blew up, the tech stocks just took it on the chin. If I remember right, some of the semiconductor ETFs were down like 25%, and the NASDAQ was like down 15% when this hit. And it's just the typical behavior because people, I always use the analogy, you get too many people on the same side of the boat and they tump the boat over. So too many people had too much leverage, too much margin, and they were using the carry trade to finance it with, where they can borrow money in Japan for almost nothing and then invest it in the market over and hype the big winners. You just never know what speculation, what was it, those of you who are a little older probably remember. I don't remember it personally, but I do remember listening to The Shadow, you know, on long car trips and stuff like that. Who knows what evil lurks in the minds of men? The Shadow knows. And he was he was the superhero who kind of had a dark side to him. Back, I'm thinking that's the 40s and 50s. But anyway, so we don't know. That's the hard part about what we do, at least in the short term, is you never know what somebody's doing that's wacky, taking extreme risk. You know that's always going to happen. Every cycle, somebody out there is doing too many speculative things with other people's money he borrows, etc., and there's some sort of blow up. But overall, if you look at the stock market today, if you look at the economy right now, the soft landing looks like it's in process. It doesn't look like a recession, with two potential black swan events to watch. I'm looking back at our Election Blues newsletter from September 6th, and I'm sitting here going, okay, look, the unemployment rate keeps rising. Once it keeps going, once it starts to rise, and this thing showed going all the way back to 1948. Once you breached a certain level on the unemployment rate, you went on into a recession. 11 of the first 11 times. This one was the 12th time, and it didn't work.
Right.
It just goes to show, rules are made to be broken. You know, their past performance is no guarantee of future results. I'm looking at the top of the second the newsletter I'm putting out this month, which is not done yet. I don't know when it'll be done. Might be next week. Might be a little later. I'm guessing next week. But it shows a similar outcome. It shows the Ned Davis economic tightening model. And I found, we started working with them about, a year and a half ago. And I found that I really think they're extremely accurate, maybe the most accurate in many ways of the people that we subscribe to. And we spend gazillions of dollars on research around here. Anyway, they have a similar chart. This is their own proprietary economic timing model, so it's different than the NBER. It's different than the one that most people rely on, which is where you proclaim you're going to have a recession. And I haven't bothered. I haven't tried to get into their secret sauce. I probably won't. I might ask them someday, by the way, what's your secret sauce in here? We're not trying to duplicate it. But they have a similar approach to this. They show downturns in the economy, and once they reach a certain threshold, and the chart is hard to envision a chart on radio, but just think of it, okay, zero is your axis in the middle, horizontal chart. Once it penetrates zero and goes to minus 10, minus 5, or whatever, every time it's done that, 11 times since, 1948 or so, we've had 11 recessions. 11 out of 11. Pretty good track record. Guess what it did this time? It fooled us all. Same story. It went down into the territory which has always produced a recession, and then it turned back up, and now it's in clear expansion mode. So that will be in this month's newsletter, by the way, when I finish it. So the issue here is you have to say sometimes there's an anomaly, and all I can do is blame it on Trump. I think that the Trump win and the decisiveness of his win, even though I realize he's got a thin majority rather in the House and the Senate, I still think that the enthusiasm from the changes he's making are going to really make a big difference this year. The black swans that we're watching for now, and if you haven't been following this on the radio for a while, a black swan is something that, from a pure mathematical standpoint, no one could ever foresee at all. From the way we tend to use it in the economy, it may be known, but it's not a primary risk. It's something that just kind of comes out of the blue. And so I still think that the primary black swan is Iran and Israel. So I spoke to one of the guys, again, at the National Religious Broadcasters Convention. It's funny how it popped into people that I needed to see and reacquaint with. And maybe I'll mention his name. Anyway, don't mind. His name is Jim Gardel. I follow him a lot on Facebook. And I've spoken. He used to be the pastor of a very big Wesleyan church in California, in San Diego. And I've spoken at his church multiple times. Anyway, I ran into him. And, you know, here you go around the corner, and boom, there he is. So we started talking, and he kind of blew my horn for me when he told the people with him.
We should hire him as your hype man.
We should, yeah, PR guy, because he said, Jerry perfectly predicted the meltdown in the housing market for the exact right reasons in 2005 and 2006. And so he was, but he also remembered why. It wasn't just he remembered that we had predicted it. He actually called out what we did, what we said, and why it happened. And he said it went exactly the way Jerry said it.
Which is in your book, Boom, Bust, and Beyond.
Yeah,
anybody wants to read it.
True. You ought to be reading it if you haven't, or rereading it. So anyhow, but at the interview, I talked to him kind of off to the side because he didn't want to talk real loud about what I'm about to tell you. And I just said, okay, to me, the primary risk of the economy and the market this year is a black swan. It would be if Israel decides to attack Iran and take their nuclear facilities out. Now, I know his wife, her maiden name is Schindler, and might have something to do with, if you remember the show Schindler's List. So she has Jewish background connections there. She's a born-again Christian at this point, but the bottom line is he has a lot of connections into Israel, and he travels extensively all over the world. This is one of those can't guarantee anything kind of quotes. But I told him, I said, the things that I'm seeing, I mentioned Matt Gertkin had said 75% probability that Israel will take out Iran this year. And if you didn't hear that interview, I would encourage you to get that. But I questioned Matt about this extensively because when I first read the newsletter, as I said before, I almost just skipped over it because I'm thinking these are things that are unlikely to happen. Well, it's kind of reverse psychology. What's unlikely to happen is that we have a negotiated peace with Iran. And he said, no, he thinks that the odds are 75% that Israel will try to take Iran out this year. He said, why? Because, number one, their enemies are very weak and mostly defeated at this point. Syria's wiped off the map. Hezbollah is way weakened. Hamas is mostly almost destroyed. The Houthis are behaving because Trump's in office, probably. But he said this is the consensus amongst the parliament over there and the leaders, even if Netanyahu is not leading, the consensus is that they're going to try to attack Iran now, because if they wait 5 or 6 years, as Matt Gertkin said, if they wait 5 or 6 years to do this, they don't know who's going to be in the White House. They don't know if the White House occupant will support them. And by that time, their enemies will have time to rebuild. So right now is the prime time to strike, and I'm not predicting that. But Matt Gertkin thinks it's a 75% probability. So anyway, I talked to Garlo about this because I knew he had government connections. He's over there ministering amongst the people and trying to bring people over there that are in the Israeli parliament and so forth, and he knows a lot of the insiders over there. He kind of whispered to me, yeah, this is what's going to happen, and Trump's going to back him. And so you can take that for what it's worth, take it with a grain of salt if you want, but that to me is the primary risk. So if we look at the economy today, right now the fourth quarter GDP came in at 2.3%. Solid, not hyper-accelerating, but very solid. The Atlanta Fed is now projecting the GDP for quarter one to be 2.3%, right in line with the fourth quarter. So layoffs, how many of those are we going to have with the Doge thing? I don't know. That's kind of a mini risk. I wouldn't say it's a big risk. The six-month trend for the leading index of economic indicators is now moving up pretty strongly. It softened in January due to weather. Consumer spending, this is a very positive sign for the economy. up 4.2% annualized rate in Q4. Consumer spending, as we talked about in our book, From Boom to Bust and Beyond, is between two-thirds and 80% of the whole economy. So if the consumers are spending at 4.2% annual rate, that's above the GDP. That's a very positive sign. Inflation expectations, though, are rising as well. So what's happening is people are getting a little bit of, you know, cold feet over the inflation expectations, which I think is rightly so. A lot of the Fed is asking for, you know, they've said they have a stated goal of 2% of inflation here in this cycle. My thinking is they're not going to hit that. I don't think they're even getting close to that unless there is a recession. A recession would pull it way back down again. Recession doesn't look likely, but what happens is, what happens if and when we have, if the Israelis do end up attacking Iran and they take out a bunch of stuff, Iran's not just going to sit there and passively take it. They're going to try to blow things up everywhere they can. They'll rearm the Houthis. They'll try to take out and close the Straits of Hormuz. There's pandemonium. It would likely be fairly short-lived. You know, when Saddam invaded Kuwait and he set 1,000 oil wells on fire over there, that was a pretty significant event in world history, in the Middle East, of course. But how long did it affect the U.S. economy? A little over a calendar quarter, about two quarters. How long did the bear market happen during that time? It lasted, essentially the top of the market was like January 31st or so of 89. Then we went into the recession, and the first part of 1990 it was over. And so essentially it was a short-lived recession. It was a short-lived bear market. It wasn't a mega bear. It wasn't a daddy bear. It wasn't a secular bear. It was a short-term bear market. So that's kind of what I could see as a potential outcome for this year, as a what we call, again, a cyclical bear market. But I don't see it happening unless the Middle East does blow up. But a cyclical bear within the context of what we call a secular bull market, meaning short-term, 20% drop, 30% drop, somewhere in that range would constitute a mama bear or cyclical bear market. Secular bear is a horse of a different color, to borrow a phrase from The Wizard of Oz. That is the secular bear is one of the really big ones, like 2008. Don't think that makes sense at this point, unless nukes get out of control. That's the only way that could make any sense.
Well, you brought up a couple of things that I think are important, too. The market is very, very focused for the past couple of years on what the Fed does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we always see, if you look at the common financial, the general financial press out there, they're always talking about what the Fed. And you mentioned two things about the Fed, but bring them back together. You said inflation's sticky right now.
Right.
And we don't expect it to go down to their goal unless there's a recession. And you also kind of mentioned there briefly with Musk and Doge going in there and laying off everybody in the government, that's going to rise unemployment,
right?
Which is their dual mandate.
So they're
going to struggle with both sides of the mandate. Inflation's not looking like it's going to go down to their target.
That makes
and
sense.
And unemployment may be increasing.
And if unemployment increases back up again, that puts you right back on the chart that we put out on the election blues in September. So
right, and those are opposite directions for what they want to do. They typically lower rates when unemployment goes up.
Right.
They typically raise rate when inflation doesn't come down.
This is the definition, and Alan Greenspan predicted this perfectly. You know, I got a quote that I use in our slide deck from him circa 2017.
Mm-hmm.
He said the next decade is going to be like the 70s. Stagflation. And he said that in 2017, when we were in the middle of the long, prolonged, slow growth of the economy after the bubble in 2008, virtually nobody was listening to him then. Everybody ought to be listening to what he said now, but I think he's just forgotten. That's been forgotten. But he said the next decade, talking about the 2020 to 2030 decade, would be unlike any we've had since the 1970s. Stagflation. Stagflation, if you're not familiar with the term, stagnant economic growth and inflation, but with a big inflation period. So again, we've talked about this, but it's been a while. If you overlay the inflation from the late 60s to 1980 with today's inflation rate and what we've seen, they're almost mirror images.
It's unbelievable
and
how close they
past
are.
Past performance is no guarantee, of course, but people tend to, as I guess it was Mark Twain said, history rhymes. You know, it doesn't repeat itself exactly. And right now, we've got the downwave of inflation, so I'm not particularly worried about inflation getting out of control in the short run, but it's persistent. It is truly sticky. I don't see it going back to 2. So I think probably we have a year or two of a benign period for inflation, and then we start to see it accelerate in the second half of the decade again. So the bottom line is, and by the way, if you're not signed up for our special reports, we don't charge for it, and we don't share our mailing list with anyone over and out. Sign up for it. I cannot guarantee when it's coming out. I'd hope to have it out sooner rather than later, but it's looking like probably next week would be a best guess. But right now, the economy is, it's not fast growth economy, but it's firing on all cylinders. So your car's got 8 cylinders, or also 8 are hitting, and you're driving 45, 50 miles an hour. You're not driving 70 or 100, and you're not going to get there. So the consumer spending is the key, but if we have a big issue, inflation to me is not the big key right now. Low risk of recession unless the black swans come and get us. One of the questions will be, and this could cause some, I think this would cause more indigestion rather than really massive change. The layoffs related to the government, housing looks like it's probably bottoming, and that's, housing is the one part, and again, that's in this coming special report. We've got a chart in here, went back to the Bolio brothers, and they show the different sectors of the marketplace, and housing right now is the only part that's in a recession. The rest of the market, some of the sectors of the economy, financials, wholesale trade, and production are now out of a recession. They went down into recession, now they're back up, and then the rest of the things look like they're going to have a soft landing. So it's not going to be a hard recession, barring some hidden shock that we don't know about right
and
now.
And as a reminder, he's saying go sign up for it. You can sign up for it at cornerstonereport.com.
Right.
It's cornerstonereport.com. All right, Jerry. Well, I just interrupted you there to get the website out there for anybody who wants to go sign up for the newsletter. But what else you got on the market?
So, again, if we talk about the market, again, this looks like a short-term correction to me, not likely to be the beginning of a bear market. The biggest risk is Iran. But some things to watch, and we're going to be watching this for you, so you don't have to necessarily know how to do this or where to get the data. But the warnings that we're going to watch, so in other words, you never know what could happen. So one of our foundational principles we use is don't presume the future. And then, again, that's in the book of James, chapter 4. Don't say you're going to go in such and such a city and buy or sell, say if the Lord wills. You can't take the future for granted, period. You've always got to be watching for the positives and the negatives.
Well, and plus, I would say our internal research, David McCord, or
right.
CMT, along with a lot of the researchers we're reading, they're all saying the trend is still currently in an upward trend.
Right.
With caution, though.
Right.
And they're talking about these warnings, and so these are the warnings they're all looking for.
It is. One of them is what we call the advanced decline line. Advanced decline, how many stocks are going up divided by how many are going down. Real simple calculation. That peaked several months ago. Before you go into a bear, let's say that there is a black swan this year, and we do go into a bear, usually the advanced decline line will peak prior to a bear market. And that's normally the case. So like in the 2000 bear, for example, it peaked like 18 months ahead of time. That's probably not going to be that long. But the advanced decline line has peaked months ago, right after the election, and it's that bears watching. So if that keeps deteriorating, then it becomes a warning. Right now it's not. Right now it's kind of a yellow light. It's not a red light. New highs and versus the market where stocks hit new all-time highs, same story, peaked several months ago, right after the election. Margin debt is very high, but probably not as high as it could go. So I could easily see the potential to have another. We're in a consolidation period right now. Market's going sideways. People are trying to figure out what to do next. Okay, what's the trend going to be this year? What's going to drive it? Is it Doge? Is it, you know, the Fed? Is it, you know, there's all sorts of uncertainties out there right now that people are aware of, and so it's making them not sure which way they want to go. And so we're in this consolidation period where market's essentially going sideways, and just in the last week or so, it's gone back down where it was in the fall. You know, in December. So it's kind of sketchy in the short term, but I think if you could make the case that the margin debt, if it hasn't peaked and it doesn't look like it's hit the peak yet, then that would very potentially lead us to another run sometime starting in the second quarter, taking us out to maybe August or September, and then watch out. This depends on if our black swan hits or not, if Israel attacks Iran. And Netanyahu's been having a lot of meetings with Trump. I have a feeling they've been talking about this kind of stuff. So, again, right now the Magnificent Seven are underperforming. Is this a permanent long-term trend change? Again, that would lead me to say if this the Magnificent Seven do peak out, what we call the terminal peak. A terminal peak means it's the peak for this bull market. It has this dunce cap-looking spike. It comes back down, and once it goes down enough, you can cross the line and say, okay, it looks like the top is in, not a top. Last summer, we had a top. We didn't have the top. This one, you got to watch that because that bears watching. So consolidation in the middle of this move usually means a continuation of the bull market later. We'll have to watch that again. Strength in consumer staples, healthcare, that may widen out and change, especially if the Magnificent Seven start getting favor again. In the meantime, earnings per share in the fourth quarter up 15%. That's the strongest since COVID rebound. So right now, all systems are go, but there are two or three things to watch out of the corner of your eye for risk. And the main one to me is Iran. We're going to do an entire section on Iran and Matt Gerken in the new newsletter. So if you haven't signed up for it yet, Michael, you can tell them about it.
All right. Like Jerry mentioned, I would like to take a small break to remind you how you can learn more about Cornerstone Financial Services and Jerry Tuma. You can find us at cornerstonereport.com. That's cornerstonereport.com. To reach out for a free consultation, just call us at 1-800-327-4285. That's 800-327-4285. We're not a high-pressure people. None of us are trained in sales to try to get you on the hook right now. That's just not who we are. When you call us, we'll just find out a little bit more about you. You can find out more about us, and we'll see if we're a good fit or not. And if we are, we'll keep talking. And if we're not, we'll wish you well and just encourage you to keep listening so you can stay abreast of the markets and the economy. You can also get Jerry's special reports and sign up for Jerry's special reports on our website, cornerstonereport.com. You can listen to previous broadcasts and interviews. Again, just click on the Smart Money Radio tab on our website. You can also find us on podcasts on most of your platforms that you prefer, but especially Apple, Spotify, and Amazon Audible. All right, Jerry, in the first half, we're talking about the market, the economy, what's going on currently in those. Now we want to switch gears a little bit. Every now and then, we'd like to bring back up what's going on in the precious metal world, just kind of keep everybody updated. So we figured this would be a good time to give your update, your outlook for gold, but start with the kind of the history of gold.
I want to, start with the history. Now, this is some of this material you'll find in the newest Cornerstone report, which, again, is not finished yet. But I just felt like, hey, this is a good time. I've been for over a year now, I've been saving up articles from our specialists on gold. Now, keep in mind, the guys that are writing the research that I'm going to quote from now and put in the newsletter are not gold bugs. They don't sell gold. Most of their analysis, typically like Alpine Macro is one of the bigger proponents of it, their primary focus is stocks and bonds almost across the board exclusively. I think they've got like 16 economists on board. And so they're not hypesters. You know, unfortunately with what goes on a lot of times in conservative media, many times there's hypesters that hype the, you know, to make sales because that's what pays the commissions, what the commissions pay the radio bill or whatever. And I'm not going to go there, but the bottom line is this is not coming from people that are hyping it. It's not coming, you know, the old story about when you have a hammer and that's the only tool you have, everything looks like a nail. You know, sometimes this is how I look at the gold market. Is it okay? Well, I have one hammer and it's gold, so I'm going to hammer everything.
So these researchers, they get paid for their advice no matter if gold prices go up or down.
Yeah, they could care less in terms of we subscribe.
They just want you to know what their outlook is.
Pay an expensive fee annually for their subscription service. Let me go back just before I get into some of the current stuff, and I'm going to have a lot more than that in the newsletter. We'll probably continue this a little bit next week. But the bottom line is I want to go into kind of the history of gold. Now, people speculate on what was money back in the day? Cavemen, did they trade with rocks? I don't know. One of the things that you probably should figure out, in order to be money, in order to have something that's money, number one, it has to be portable. Well, you can make little rocks portable if you wanted to, but you have to be able to carry it with you. Land is not money. Land is land. Every investment has a different way of looking, different pluses and minuses, etc. So you have to have portability to have something that can be a money substitute. Gold has been money basically throughout recorded history as far as anyone can tell. Another reason thing that it has to have is scarcity. Okay, so caveman number one comes over and says, I want to buy your skin coat here that you made, such a beautiful skin coat. Here's a bunch of rocks. Well, what's that guy going to do? You look at him like, are you stupid? There's a million rocks right here in front of me. I'm not going to take your rocks and give you this skin coat that I made. So it has to have scarcity. So what has happened is that we've had this departure from how gold has always been traded. Back in the day, we've talked about this many times. Basically, the Chinese, as best we can tell, Marco Polo talked about this in 1200 A.D., the Chinese appear to be the ones that kind of started gold certificates or gold depositories kind of things, because what they would do is they started out using paper money, and Marco Polo was there for a short period of time, and he basically said, hey, this is the most great invention I've ever seen, paper money. The emperor never has to tax people. All he does is goes and prints it, and they spend it, and everybody's happy. No taxes, no rebellions. But he didn't stay around long enough to realize that about every 50 or 60 years, that economy went into total collapse and hyperinflation, because you just keep printing paper money out, you know, forever and ever and ever, and your paper money becomes worth paper. It's not worth whatever is printed on the front of the bill. Now, right now, America's not in that position. But I do wonder about that if we have another, let's say, next decade. What if there is a World War III? Not saying we're going to, not guaranteeing it. I think it is a distinct possibility, though. Where are you going to go with the budget deficit then? Right now, our budget deficit is $36 trillion and counting. Now, Trump and Doge and Elon Musk are going to try to trim that back, but, and this will be another special report I'm anticipating I'll be writing later, they're going to be trimming it. They're not going to be stopping it. The advance of government spending, I don't think, is stoppable at this point. If we'd done it under Reagan, yes. If we'd done it under Bush, maybe. But we've gotten to the point where you're reaching critical mass on the entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, and so forth, and you're going to have to spend for defense, even though I realize they've missed their last seven budgets in a row in terms of audits. So bringing accountability to the government, to me, is absolute must, and cutting the unnecessary fat around it, and a lot of it is just total fraud. I remember years ago, my wife, before her stroke, went to Washington, D.C. to work with a friend of ours, Andrea Lafferty, who is basically a ministry, but she was also very involved in government, and her husband was the press secretary, one of Reagan's press secretaries, explaining what Reaganomics meant to the press, because they certainly didn't know what it meant or understand it. And basically, they did a several-week-long expose on understanding. They just took one department of the government, National Institutes of Health, and they looked in to see where they were spending all their money, which is public record, and basically the fraud and the graft and the stuff in there was just astronomical. She went and talked to the chief of staff for Kay Bailey Hutchison, not being negative about Kay, it's just the way Washington has historically always worked, and the chief of staff, first thing out of his mouth, he told my wife, he said, we're not going to cut your government benefit. Very first thing he said. And she stayed there all day to get to see this guy. She goes, I'm not moving until I see somebody important. I'm going to sit here in your office. And all the staffers tried to talk to her, tried to get her to go back in, closed doors, etc. She wouldn't do it until she found him. And he walked in the door. She said, he's the one I'm going to talk to. And he was Kay's right-hand man. Anyway, but the bottom line is, when she showed him some of the pictures that were on the NIH website, he literally fell over and almost fell over the back of his chair. He recoiled backward to the point where his chair nearly flipped over. He said, that's not the National Institutes of Health. She said, it's on your website. And it was, you know, four professors dressed in drag getting ready to go have a party who had gotten like $1 million grant to do some kind of bogus study. It's just the government has gotten out of control, totally out of control. And now but the problem is it's reaching critical mass. So the issue is, if you're dealing with cancer, and my wife's had some bouts of cancer, if it reaches critical mass and starts spreading throughout your body, you're kind of done. You really can't, you know, if it gets to a certain point, you don't reverse it outside of a miracle of God. So the point is this, you've got to cut it off before it reaches that point. We're not quite there yet, but the trajectory is that direction. So it's going to cause, I believe, havoc in the 2030s. Now, I'm all favor of Trump and Doge and Elon bringing accountability, because even the Defense Department, even though that's very necessary, and I think it will probably have to expand in the coming decade, it's ridiculous that they're not accountable. I mean, who? Publicly traded companies are accountable to the public. You know, you have to produce, you know, here's our results, here's our accounting, here's our numbers. What happens to a stock if their numbers are bogus? If the numbers get messed up and they go, oh, we made an accounting error, the stock goes down 30% the next day. So the issue is you have to have accountability, and no one's ever brought the government into accountability before, ever. So that's one of the big things I think Trump's going to do, and Elon and so forth, and it's the right thing to do. It's overdue. It should have happened 20 years ago, but better late than never on that one. But the bottom line is that gold has always been a store of value. It's always been stable. Now, again, I'm not a gold bug per se in terms of hawking this, and we do have gold for our clients. It's not for the general public. We do set it up. And I won't go into great detail on that unless your client will tell you more about it. But the bottom line is we know how to do it. We know we're not going to rip people off. The gold industry, unfortunately, I heard one guy when I was changing broker-dealers one time, he said it's a dirty industry. And I won't make it any more detailed than that, but it's unregulated. If it's unregulated, then man's nature is going to take it to the wrong direction. Some are very good and very high-quality people, and some are not. That's just the way the industry is right now, unfortunately. So essentially, the gold was store of value. So where did we get paper money from? As I mentioned, it started with Marco Polo, started with China, and it when it moved into Europe, you had what we call gold depositories. So let's say you're a rich guy and you've got your own, you know, carriage and your horses, and you're traveling from one place to another, and the sheriff of Nottingham comes along, and not him, Robin Hood, comes along and says, okay, give me your gold. The bandits get you. And well, what do? If you carry your gold in your chest that's, you know, locked down on the carriage, then you're robbed, and there's nothing you can do about it. And they take your gold and doesn't have your name on it, and they go do whatever they want to do with it. So the problem is that's a difficult situation. So what they did was they invented what later became what we call fractional central reserve banking kind of thing. So the gold merchants essentially would issue you a paper certificate. Okay, we will store your gold for you in our vault, and then we will give you a certificate. This is $1,000 worth of gold or whatever, and they give you a paper certificate. And that worked fine for a while. Then after a while, what happened was people would go, okay, so I need to buy this XYZ. I'm going to go down there. Here's my certificate, give me my gold back. And go take the gold to whoever I'm buying it from, hand him the gold. What does he do? He takes the gold and goes back down to the depository and says, here, deposit my gold and give me a certificate. So it didn't take real long for people to go, wait, this is dumb. I'll just hand you my certificate. Okay, let's say it's a thousand whatever. The currency was, here it is. And so then after a while they discovered that the paper started circulating on its own without going back to the depository to pick up the gold. So it just kind of created its own little market out there, because it's inconvenient to have to go down there, pick it up, and bring it over here. Plus, you could get robbed on the way again. So the money started circulating on its own without being redeemed in gold. So the gold salesmen, the gold merchants at the time that were issuing these depository receipts for gold, kind of figured out, you know what? Very rarely does anybody come and pick up their gold here, and they start printing some bogus certificates. Bogus how? Bogus meaning they printed a certificate said I've got X amount of gold, but they didn't have gold to back it. You ever heard of fractional reserve banking? I don't know. I'm not gonna say our bank's evil. I'm saying this is the way this whole system has progressed over the years. So we had all that stuff happening. Then we had a gold standard in the 30s, which helped crash the economy. And I won't go into great detail on the gold standard. There's some big problems. Gold has always, again, been a store of value. It's always been very valuable as a commodity in world history. It is scarcity. It does hold its value long term. It has intrinsic use. But the issue is that it kind of puts the central banks in handcuffs when the crash of 29 hit. That's just, maybe someday we'll go into all the detail on that, but we don't have time on today's show. But historically speaking, gold was still a store of value for the central banks of the world. So, and most of it, again, is stored in Washington, or actually in New York, at the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. And it's funny, you probably have not, did you go with me when we went on that trip?
I did not.
We went to examine the Federal Reserve of New York and their gold holdings, and we got permission to go in for a tour. And it's really funny, because what they have is it's like a big jail cells up there, and they have bars, you know, really strongly enforced bars like a jail would, and they have little wagons, very sturdy wagons, not like your red wagon you had when you were a kid, very, very sturdy wagons that have gold bars on them. And so here's one cell over here, that's Germany's cell. Here's one cell over here, this is Holland's cell or whatever. Most of the gold is not in Europe. They have a lot in Europe, but most of it, because of what happened after World War II, came to New York. Why? Because New York, you know, the United States was fairly well untouched in terms of our country. Yes, we lost a lot of troops in World War II, but we didn't get attacked. Our physical country did not get attacked, whereas over there in Europe, it was pandemonium. So a lot of these countries stored the bulk of their gold in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. So if you get to the point where, okay, well, they're going to, you know, XYZ country is going to sell some of the gold to the other XYZ country, guess what they do? They walk over and open
up the wagon.
They open one cell, they take a certain amount over it with the thing and put it in the other cell. It's like, mm-hmm. this is crazy, but that's the way the whole thing works. Anyway, so in 1972, so what we had a system called the Bretton Woods system that was developed right after World War II. Again, I'm going to fast forward through most of this. Bottom line, though, is that Nixon closed the gold window in the 70s. So what had happened was we had a whole bunch of gold. There's talk right now about revaluing our gold. Of course, Trump's going to make sure it's still there in Fort Knox, our biggest depository for gold. But the bottom line is that America still holds the value of the gold that it owns at $35 an ounce on the books. I'm like, gold's nearly $3,000 an ounce now because of inflation and so forth and scarcity and people wanting stuff. You know, Russia dumped all of their treasuries and put all the money in gold. And that's one of the things we're going to talk about in the special report is central banks of the world are seeing, ooh, we saw what happened to Russia. Now, if you're Singapore, you don't have any ambitions to go invade Ukraine. But basically what happened was that the foreign reserves of Russia got frozen. And if you're a central banker in a different country, that's probably not a good feeling for you. I'm like, oh, we've figured out here. We've seen already that the, you know, President of the United States froze the gold reserves, not the gold reserves, but all of the financial reserves Russia had, and so did Europe. Most of it was in Europe. So they're like, uh-oh. So what had happened was, up until Nixon closed the gold window in the early 70s, I know this is a long history, folks, but hopefully you find it fascinating. What had happened was, we were still holding, Roosevelt confiscated the gold in 1933. He declared a bank holiday for a week. All banks are closed. You can't go to the bank. If you don't have money, that's just too bad. Because what we're having was the banks were failing. We had lost a third of the banks. This is the Jimmy Stewart model. Jimmy Stewart, It's a Wonderful Life. Bank panic. Everybody rushes to the bank at the same time. But the money's not here. It's in Joe's house over here. Again, fractional reserve banking. So essentially what happened was the FDIC, and Milton Friedman was an ardent critic of the Fed in the 20s and 30s. The very reason they were created was to create elastic currency so that if there is a panic or a wholesale bank, you know, failures are starting, their job was to create liquidity so that the banks could meet the deposit request or the redemption request and stay in business. And they didn't at all. And so what happened was Bank A would fail. And then guess what? Bank B might have some deposits in Bank A, and they fail. And so it just started a string of dominoes. In the 30s, there was about a third of the banks went under. One third, if you can imagine that. And, of course, there was no FDIC insurance. So to fix that, Roosevelt came along and said, okay, we're going to put, I think it's $40,000. That's what it was when I was growing up. I don't know if it was less than that back then. But here's FDIC insurance. The federal government has an agency now called the FDIC. And it will insure your deposits up to a certain amount, which I think was $40,000. It might have been lower than that when they started it. But that way you don't have to worry about your bank failing, because the government will make you whole if your bank fails. And so up to a certain limit. Then he confiscated all the gold. How did he confiscate it? He just made it illegal to own gold if you're an American citizen. He said, if you own gold, it's illegal for you. Sell your gold back to the U.S. government. And oh, by the way, for a $20 gold piece, which are called the Liberties or the St. Gaudens coins, we will give you $25. We're going to give you a 20% premium on your gold to turn it back into the government. And it was almost complete compliance. By that point, America was at such depths from the, you know, the advertised unemployment rate that most textbooks use is 25% unemployment rate during that time. I've seen other numbers that indicate it might have been closer to 35% unemployment. But the bottom line is we were in the middle of the Great Depression. The stock market had crashed 90%, and pandemonium was going on. It was totally, the whole system was frozen. So Roosevelt said, we're going to close all the banks for a week, reopen them in a week, no more bank panics. We're insuring the money that's in the bank. And by the way, he confiscated, if you want to call it that, the other medium exchange, which is gold. Because people, okay, well, here's a $20 bill backed by gold. He took the gold part of that away and said, you just got to trust us. It's now full faith and credit of the U.S. government. So that system worked until, you know, and then World War II, we had the Bretton Woods system. Again, I'm going to fast forward this whole thing instead of belaboring all these points. And America was made essentially the dominant dog of the whole universe at that point, because we had helped win World War II after helping win World War I. And bottom line is that the gold that Roosevelt bought, quote-unquote, bought from the American public for 25 an ounce when it was over, over 90% of the people, is the best estimate, complied with that. He revalued the gold to 35 an ounce. So the government made a very nice profit on that transaction. Anyway, but they held it at $35 an ounce all along. And gold, the U.S. dollar was redeemable in gold. In other words, if you couldn't own gold if you were a U.S. citizen. But if you were a foreign national bank or something like that, you could take your Federal Reserve notes and turn them in and get gold from the U.S. Treasury Department. Well, what happened was, from 1944, when they set that system up, until the early 1970s, when Nixon closed the gold window, a lot of inflation took place over that time, and these people that are foreigners are not stupid. They're like, they're still holding the gold at $35 an ounce, and it's worth a whole lot more than that now if you look at the inflation rate. So they were turning in their Federal Reserve notes to our central bank and getting gold out. So we were having a run on the bank. The foreigners were taking all the gold out of our system. So finally, Nixon said, this is unsustainable. He closed the window, meaning he made it, number one, the U.S. dollar is no longer convertible into gold. You'll trust us because we are the masters of the universe. We know it. So the gold is there, number one. Number two, the next thing would be that he made it legal. He re-legalized it, if you will, for Americans to own gold for the first time since 1933. And over that period of time, the next couple of years, gold went up to from 35 an ounce to 200, 300 an ounce. Ultimately, went over 800 at the end of the decade. So this is a very long, very detailed explanation, as fast as I can go, of the history of gold. So here's why this is important, and I'm going to give you a couple of stats out of this new newsletter that I'm working on. If you haven't gotten on our newsletter list, please go to our website. Michael will give you that in a moment. But what's happened since then? So after gold, Nixon did that, the viewpoint of the central bankers of the world was gold is a, quote, archaic relic. Okay, it's a pet rock. I heard one guy say that. I'm like, give me a break. A pet rock? No, it has been gold has been money throughout history. So again, I'm not a hawker of gold, but this whole thing changed in 2008. When 2008 financial crash hit, the people of the world wised up and said, oh, maybe we need a lot of gold after all. And so the central banks, and I'm talking about each country's central bank, like our Federal Reserve, the central banks of the world started buying gold. China went from like $12 trillion worth of dollars to $800 billion. They've diversified a lot of that going into gold. They only probably have 4 or 5% of their assets for their central bank in gold right now. But let me kind of read you a little bit of a quote. This is from Alpine Macro, because we're going to run out of time. He said, the problem is there's a very limited amount of gold to be purchased in the global markets. These huge financial institutions like the central banks, are sucking all the available supply up, and the gold mining companies of the world can produce and then some. So they're getting all the gold that's being produced annually and then a lot more. As he mentioned, central banks were net sellers of gold in the three decades following the collapse of the Bretton Woods system. However, they reversed course after the great financial crisis, rebuilding the bullion reserves to the tune of 7,800 tons of gold. Notably, more than a quarter of these acquisitions occurred in the last 2 years. And there's charts in here that show exactly how much these guys are putting into gold. It's a very scarce commodity. As he said, the market value of the gold, the world's gold stock, the amount of gold in the world is $13 trillion. Half of the form is in jewelry. Only $3 trillion held by five private investors, tradable financial assets, which pales against a market cap of $250 trillion for stocks and bonds. So $3 trillion versus $250. And what's happening is the geopolitical issues are causing more and more demand for this. We'll continue this series next week, talking a little bit more about gold, and maybe I'll have the special report finished. We'll see.
All right, so again, to see more about us, go to cornerstonereport.com. There you can sign up for Jerry's newsletter, catch our previous radio shows, including that interview Jerry's referred to multiple times today with Matt Gerken of BCA Research. We'll see you next week.
Jerry Tuma Smart Money is a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services of Dallas, Texas. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Financial advisors at Cornerstone could help you if you prefer to delegate your investment decisions to a financial professional. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. We publish a newsletter, Cornerstone Report, which is available on our website or by calling our toll-free number at 800-327-4285. That's also the number to call for more information about anything we've discussed during today's broadcast. For more information, visit our website at cornerstonereport.com. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. Remember, we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.